Welcome to the Disciple Makers Podcast, timeless truth for today's college students and tomorrow's leaders. This is your host, Tom Holland. Today we kick off a 10-part series of all the talks from the recent Women's Conference. Ladies, you're in for a treat. And guys, don't go anywhere. There's a lot for you and I to learn too. So here we go. We live in a world of diverse people. Understanding is hard, and genuine unity is even harder. So what hope do we have for bridging our differences? Becky Miller and Sarah Evans will help us examine the scriptures to learn how to love people who are different than us. Here's their workshop entitled, What's Love Got to Do with It? Living Out Gospel Unity.
Well, good morning, ladies. It's really exciting to start this workshop, especially on the heels of Jen's talk this morning. I think she set us up really well for our topic. So Sarah Evans and I this morning, we're going to be going a little bit deeper on the topic of unity this morning. And I don't know about you ladies, but I know that sometimes I look in the mirror and I think, yeah, I'm pretty good at this unity business. I mean, I don't hate people. I'm pretty cool with differences, so not a problem here. But then when I take a little bit longer of a look, I'm very aware that just being cool with differences isn't really working toward unity. Just patting myself on the back for not hating people is a far cry for actually striving toward loving people. And I know sometimes I've been part of some communities where we say we're all about unity, but the extroverts are really overpowering the introverts. Or the spreadsheet detail people are having a hard time understanding the big picture dreamers. Or sometimes we are tempted to give ourselves excuses for not inviting certain people to events because they're a little bit awkward, or we don't think we have anything in common with them. Members of our own families break out in heated arguments when we talk about the most recent presidential election. Or on campus, we're so excited when an international student comes to our fellowship, but we can get really impatient with their language skills or unintentionally exile them when we think that it's too difficult to listen. Or perhaps when an international student comes to our fellowship who's already a believer, we can try to force them into our mold instead of asking them, well, what's your church like? Or could you teach us a worship song that's popular where you're from? Or I know sometimes we white folks don't understand why the black folks got really riled up about something in the news because that headline didn't mean something to us and we didn't take the time to think about the implications of it because it didn't seem to impact people that looked like us. So it's obvious that just being okay with differences is not helping us achieve true unity. God is very aware that we tend to stick to our own kind, and getting outside of ourselves takes a lot of effort. Wholeness and unity is going to be a big part of our workshop today because we can tell by reading God's word that it's really important to him. So first, we're going to talk about how God designed things to be whole and unified in the book of Genesis. And then it got broken. And then we're going to take a look at our printed text in 1 Corinthians that's in your packet. And we're going to talk about the hope that we have for redemption and how and why we can fight for unity. And then we're going to end our time with a little bit of Q&A as time allows. And that's the reason why you have the index cards on your seats. You can be writing down some questions as you think of them and then pass them to the aisles. And then Jillian's going to be around collecting them. If you're an aisle person, you can feel free to kind of flag her a little bit with that. And now the first book of the Bible, Genesis, tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens, the earth, and everything in the earth, including humans. And we were the capstone of his creation. And unlike all the other flora and fauna, we had the privilege of being made most like him out of all things that he created. In Genesis 1:26, God says, "Let us make man in our own image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And it's a small verse, but I want to start there, and there are two things that I want us to know. We're told that we have dominion, and we're told that we're made in God's image. And what does that mean? Let me talk about image first, and then I'm going to talk about dominion. In ancient Mesopotamia, as the region would come to be known, being in the image of someone meant that you not only had the appearance physically, but you also represented the character and the power of that thing. Someone made in a god's image was like a representation of his or her identity. And in this region, they thought image was so commanding that some kings, when they would conquer a region, they would put up monuments and images of themselves in that area to show that they were the conqueror of that region. And we don't quite do that today, but images are still something that's really important to us, and they set someone apart as being part of something. For instance, have any of you met my daughter, Rosie? She looks so much like my husband. And not just him, but his mom and his sister, too. I have this picture of the three of them all mushed together that you can look at the end. And a friend who came to our house put it very, very plainly when he just looked at them and said, same face. There is no mistaking who Rosie belongs to. She's part of our family. And now, dominion might not be a word in your everyday vocabulary, unless maybe you play a lot of strategy games. I know it's not in mine. But it is used in the creation account of Genesis, because having dominion is a way of saying that we are caretakers of everything God created. All of the resources he created were to be used as we fulfilled God's purpose for us. And that purpose included spreading out and filling the earth with more people, as well as being on a grand adventure quest of learning more about God as he revealed himself through nature and through reaching out to us. It's not a bad purpose for humankind, right? Being explorers and benevolent caretakers. When you put image and dominion together, it creates a beautiful picture of representing God to the world. We were designed to do this as we work together. And in the first few chapters of Genesis, there are four people mentioned. There are two groups of two in relationship to each other. And if you're learning OIA Bible study skills, you have learned that contrast in a passage are something to pay attention to. There are two separate examples of people who are different from each other, and that came very soon after God establishes that we are bearers of his image and have a purpose that requires us to work together. So let me quickly break down the examples, and then I'll tell you what the real problem is. In the narrative, God first creates a man and afterward proclaims that it's not good for that man to be alone. So God makes another version of what an image bearer can be, and that is a woman. Men and women are physically and emotionally different and sometimes can have very different skills and interests and viewpoints. In fact, you may even hear people joking sometimes like, God must be playing a cruel joke on us to make men and women so different. But if we look at the loving kindness displayed by our Creator in this passage, making a perfect home and helping Adam not to be alone, it's obvious that this was not a cruel joke. I urge you to believe that this was a step that God was doing that was in our best interest. He was deliberately making the first two people very different, and it was called good because they completed one another and they imaged God together. Unfortunately, if you know the story, they also sinned together. And that drove a wedge in their relationship and even in subsequent human and wife relationships. A little later in the story, Adam and Eve have two sons, Cain and Abel, who grow up to be men themselves. Even in Cain and Abel, he made two different brothers from the same family with different abilities and interests. Cain was a farmer and Abel was a shepherd. Cain offered a crop of vegetables to the Lord, and Abel offered a sacrifice of an animal. And the text doesn't express why, but God accepted Abel's offering to the Lord and not Cain's. Cain was angry, and the Lord reached out to him and encouraged him not to sin, but Cain chose to seek out his brother, and he killed him. He brought big consequences on himself. The problem wasn't that he was different, it was that he sinned against God. And so we see in both stories, differences aren't the problem, friends, but sin is. Now, Sarah is going to come up and explain a little bit more about what sin does.
So what happens next? Let's look at how sin has impacted the diversity of our world. Because as Becky stated, our differences weren't the problem. Sin was. As human beings, I think we very easily mistake uniformity for unity. So following me, we often think we have unity, but what we really have is destructive uniformity. Genesis 11 tells the story of the Tower of Babel. Verse 1 begins, "The whole earth had the same language and vocabulary." That sounds pretty good, right? I mean, imagine a world with no language barrier. A world where there is limited opportunity for misunderstanding, where everyone belongs to the same culture and has the same uniform identity. You don't have to explain cultural differences. There are none. There's comfort in uniformity. People are the same as me. There's security. Nobody's trying to attack me because we belong to the same people group. And at Babel, we see people working together, creating technology, making plans to build a city with a tower with its top in the sky. So what's the problem here? You see that while uniform identity, comfort, and security all seem like positives, there's a dark reality lurking underneath. First, in their identity, they forget the Lord. That's your first fill-in. They forget the Lord. As you read Babel's story, the people announce, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the sky. Let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered throughout the earth." Did anybody notice the repeated words there? Us, ourselves. The people have turned from worshiping the Lord and care only for their reputation, their glory. They become all about the greatness of their name and their city. Never once do they mention the Lord. Their identity is all about their common accomplishments. They exchange the glory of getting to image God in their world for the shallow glory of boasting in whatever they think they can accomplish, forgetting the fact that it was God who gave them those skills and ability to create in the first place. Second, in their comfort, they forget their purpose. They forget their purpose. Now, we've already established that the first reason they want to build a tower is to glorify themselves. But did you catch the second reason? To avoid being scattered throughout the earth. Now, Becky just told us, what was God's charge to humanity on the day he created them? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and have dominion over it. Humans were supposed to engage in an epic venture quest of discovering the world and in the process learn more about the God who created it all. But what did they actually do? At Babel, humanity turned away from an epic adventure and constructed a brick playpen. When I was a child, I feared everything. My dad, however, was and is Captain Adventure. I mean, horseback riding, water skiing, whatever, you name it, the man did it and he's good at it. And he wanted to teach me all those things, but I was afraid. And treasuring my comfort zone, I refused to learn many of the things he wanted to teach me. And so today, there are big ways that I am actually not in the image of my father because I let my fear get in the way and I refused. Treasuring our comfort zones means missing out on our purpose, the reason we're here on this planet. And finally, your last fill-in, in their uniform security, they forget that they are image bearers. The people forget that what binds them is not primarily shared culture or language or physical appearance, but rather sharing the identity of an image bearer of God. They forget that their common creator is more important than the trappings that they wear or the slang that they use. And the story of Babel ends by God deciding to mix up their languages and actually forcing them to spread throughout the earth so they won't be able to go any further down this path of destructive uniformity. And sadly, by putting their security in their sameness rather than in their God, the divided people groups rapidly turned against each other, And we see this throughout the rest of history. But what does this look like in our world? Why is it hard to choose unity over uniformity? Have you ever been in the situation where you were a minority? Perhaps you are a person of color at a majority white school. Perhaps you studied abroad where very few people spoke your language. Did you find yourself the lone Patriots fan in the room when the Eagles won the Super Bowl? To be in a position where you feel like you don't always fit in is lonely, and it can be exhausting. I came from a rural working class background, and I remember being so excited to go to Gettysburg College. I was gonna study history, I was gonna learn so much, it was gonna be great. And then I got there for my freshman semester, and it was not what I was expecting. Before me was a sea of salmon pants. I remember a girl on my floor casually telling me that her family had a summer home in Germany that they went to every year. The clothes and the cars and the New England culture just really took me by surprise and left me feeling like a fish out of water. I got a little bit patronized for growing up on a farm. Somebody's saying, oh, did you actually take care of the animals? Yeah, I did. It's a farm. That's the point. And after a really rough first semester, I made an unlikely best friend. Mimi came from a working class family, black family in Brooklyn, New York. And partially, we felt drawn together because we both felt like we didn't fit in. And as she was helping me prepare for this session, I asked her to reflect a little bit and summarize how did she feel coming to college. And she summarized it like this: because I didn't fit in, it made me want to change. I hid my hair in braids, I bought different clothes, and I tried to speak like everyone else on campus. But it didn't work well. I felt like I was losing pieces of myself to fit in. You see, being the minority in any way, race, culture, interest, personality, can be scary. There are fears of rejection, fears of not being heard or understood, fears of retaliation for being different. Willingly putting yourself in a situation where you won't automatically be part of the crowd is not a task for the faint-hearted. Or perhaps, as I'm talking, you're thinking, well, actually, I haven't had that many experiences of being a minority in some way. And I really want you to think, why is that? Have you actively avoided interactions with people different than you? Or perhaps, as you think, you just honestly have not had that much opportunity. Your friends are the people in your major or on your sports team. Your roommates like and dislike the same things that you do. Have you stayed inside your bubble because it's easy for you? And when you interact with people who are different, do you try to force them to see things your way? Do you only interact with people on your terms? Have you lived your life so self-centered that you have never even thought to get out of your comfort zone and seek to understand someone different than you? You see, fear is often what stops us from going outside our bubbles of uniformity. How many of you saw the movie High School Musical? Well, if you're one of the lucky ones who did not see it and did not have those songs branded into your brain, I think the scene that I'm gonna describe will still be familiar. The high school cafeteria. Every table has its own identity. Jocks, nerds, skaters, white kids, black kids, everything in between. The status quo, the social hierarchy, has been firmly established, and the groups are so divided that they don't even associate with each other. But suddenly, a few characters begin to make confessions. The jock likes to bake. The nerd likes hip-hop dancing. The skater kid plays the cello. Do you remember the response? No, 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 no. Stick to the stuff you know. It is better by far to keep things as they are. Don't mess with the flow. No, no. Stick to the status quo. Shut down. And we, like the characters, are afraid that if we step out, we'll do something wrong. We'll be misunderstood or possibly rejected. We fear what the people in our bubble might think if we start to change or deviate from the path. But I want you to see that that fear keeps us divided, because fear leads to not getting to know and understand. Not understanding leads to misunderstanding. Misunderstanding very easily leads to hatred. And hatred leads to justifying all kinds of evil against each other, and sin abounds. Rather than being created different to serve the Lord together, we chop the image of God into broken, fragmented cliques. And we don't see the image of God as our identity. Instead, we see whatever labels we have created for ourselves and for each other. You know, and we watch movies like High School Musical or Mean Girls, and we know that uniformity is wrong. We even mock the characters for their short-sighted bigotry. But we do the same thing. Very few of us walk away from a movie like that with the risk-taking conviction to change. Do you see that doing that makes you and I just as foolish as those at Babel? Let us make a name for ourselves. Now, some of you here may not identify as Christians. You may even believe that religion is what causes war and division in our world. You know, and largely, I would agree with you. See, man-made, man-constructed religion, worshiping our own creations and clinging to uniformity, is self-destructive. We see it at Babel. Or perhaps you are a Christian and you've seen or experienced some within the church try to build false unity by manipulating uniformity, what to wear, how to worship. Wherever you are on that spectrum, I really want you to see today that this is not how the God of the universe wants us to live. Uniformity has a dark and dangerous side that does not honor God. When we become about our identity, our comfort, and our security above all else, we are not living out our purpose as image bearers made to glorify the Lord. And yet, much of what we see in the world is division. Division over race, class, economics, the color of that dress, was it blue and white or black and gold? You know, true unity sounds great, but does it really exist? And how on earth is meaningful unity possible? And that brings us to our third point. What's love got to do with it? Let's jump forward in the Bible to the book of 1 Corinthians. And the reason we're doing that is because I think if you were a Corinthian living in the first century, you would probably be asking yourself some similar questions. The New Testament was written in the context of the Roman Empire. This time period was called the Pax Romana, Roman peace. But that's kind of a laughable name when you realize that the peace the Romans held dear was only possible because they were oppressing the rest of the known world. I mean, this was a time period where everybody who was not a Roman was literally called and classified barbarian, and 35% of the population was enslaved. And this society, this deeply divided society, is the society that Christianity entered into. And I want you to keep this context in the back of your mind as we're diving into this call to unity, because if it was possible in their context, it is in ours too. Because the Corinthian church was diverse and divided. Some members were wealthy Roman citizens living a life of privilege. Others were poor Jewish refugees who had been forced to flee persecution. People from all over the world lived in this city. Some had worshiped God a long time. Others were just starting to investigate what this whole Jesus thing was about. And how did Paul want this group of believers, very different individuals, to view their identity, comfort, and security? First, their identity, a body that glorifies the Lord. In chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians, Paul writes that believers have part of a new identity. They are a body that glorifies the Lord. Jesus is the head, and everyone else are the various parts of this body. And while the parts look different, are composed of slightly different matter, and have different functions, they are all carefully made and have a purpose only they can carry out for the good of the rest of the body. Let's look a little bit at some of the word choice and the grammar here. Let's start in verse 12. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. All are one. Present tense, definitive, an ongoing reality. Becoming a Christian means automatically becoming a part of this body. Look at verse 15. You actually can't opt out of this. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong in the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. You don't get to say that because you are different or because you don't like the parts around you, that you get to sit out. See, kind of like when you marry somebody, in a sense, you also marry their family. Joining yourself to Jesus means joining yourself to his family. Let's keep going. Look at verse 18. God has arranged each one of the parts of the body just as he wanted. Diverse people being unified as God's family is a biblical reality. If you are a Christian, this is your world. And because God has built this body, no one can look down on or devalue or discount any other part. For any body to work properly, you need all the parts. You need diverse unity to function. Verse 21, and if they were all the same part, where would the body be? The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. The head cannot say to the rest of the body, I don't need you. I mean, think about it. How weird and how useless would an entire body of feet be? Recently, I was talking with an LVC student about what it means to be a Christian woman. And suddenly she blurted out, I have something to tell you, and you might not like it. I said, okay, all right. And she continued, I am never starting a blog or going thrift shopping. I am not a coffee enthusiast, and I do not care about artsy Instagram photos. And it was my joy to tell her, you don't have to be any of those things. I mean, if that's your thing and you like it, go for it. But you don't have to. And that example might seem silly, but if you are trying to be someone or something else, you are not fulfilling the role God gave you. Your gifts, your personality, your skills were given to you for the redemptive purpose of glorifying the Lord. We are called to imitate Christ and to look like him, no one else. I can guarantee you the Corinthian church was not uniform. They would not have all looked the same, dressed the same, had the same socioeconomic status. People came from different cultural traditions. Some of them had really serious sin struggles they were still working through. Struggles with drinking addiction, struggles with sexual immorality, struggles with ethnic bias. They most definitely were not all suburban, middle-class citizens with a white picket fence, 2.5 kids, and a retriever. But you know what? That is exactly how God wanted it. God did not create a cookie cutter mold to force people into. He created a body with various parts, each part created equal with a specific purpose only it can fulfill. And if you were to read the book of 1 Corinthians, you might be tempted to call this group of individuals a dysfunctional band of misfits with some very serious issues. And truthfully, they were. And so are we. But how does God see them? If you were to read the opening of this letter, it is addressed to those sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints together with all those who in every place call upon the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. So what is their identity? And what is ours if we are a Christian? Sanctified, chosen saints, unified with anyone, anywhere, who calls upon the name of the Lord Jesus. Jesus did not make a cookie cutter. He made a diverse body. You see, unity is not the same as uniformity. Uniformity says we need to be exactly the same, and if we're not, we're going to have problems. But the real problem with uniformity is that it's weak. Even worse, it is foolish. I mean, remember High School Musical? How easy was it for those cliques to dissolve once just a few people were willing to take a risk and build unity? I mean, it only took one musical number. We're all in this together. So unity says we do have differences, but those differences balance and strengthen each other when they are equally valued. There is great strength to unity. Our differences were custom made by the Lord to reflect the whole picture of His image. But how do people with so many differences stand together unified? By making the passionate choice of the heart to love one another. Becky is going to come back up and tell us how to do that. And if you have questions, Jillian is going to come through the aisles. You can pass your index cards to her.
So let's talk about comfort. We're approaching wedding season, right? Maybe my connection wasn't quite that clear. But chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, right? I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have heard it at weddings. Beautiful syrupy tones, and there's a couple, and everyone's happy. So it's a really popular passage, but I think it probably ranks among one of the least understood. So that's why we're going to read it today in its context of how it would have fit with 1 Corinthians 12. So it's in your packet, and I'm going to go ahead and read it. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable and resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. And as for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. But we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, and I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now I see in a mirror dimly, and then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall be known fully, even as I have been fully known. For now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Now, sure, some of these characteristics really do apply to a biblical marriage, but we need to consider the passage in its context, right? And we need to remember this is written to a young, multi-ethnic church and not a starry-eyed couple in love. Look at the last verse of chapter 12 as it leads into 13, because Paul was getting ready to answer the question, how do people with so many differences stand together unified? And we'll look at Paul's answer, because verses 1 through 3 are kind of these attention-getting questions, and then he gets really practical starting in verse 4. To love each other means to approach our differences with patience, kindness, no jealousy, no boasting, no arrogance, not to see differences and respond with rudeness or self-seeking or irritation. To love each other means not to keep a record of wrongs. And we're not supposed to rejoice in unrighteousness, but rather to rejoice in the truth, because loving each other means bearing with each other, believing the best of each other, staying hopeful while enduring together, because this love never ends. Even when everything else in this world is falling apart, this love will remain. And this can be a pretty unromantic call. It's gritty, it's humbling. It requires sacrificing our freedoms and privileges to serve one another. Love like this is better than romance, though, because love like this is determined to stay together as brothers and sisters in Christ, even when the rest of the world tries to force us back into whatever uniformity mold it's trying to tell us to be in. Because taking risks and being called out of our comfort zone to image Christ to the world is part of our purpose. Let me give you two stories about being uncomfortable as I've tried to image Christ to the world. A number of years ago, I was in North Africa helping with a school, and one day some of the teenage girls wanted to fix my hair. They asked me what oil I had packed to style it, and they seemed a little concerned when I said, I don't use oil. So they said, we're going to use some of what we use. This is what we know to do. So they put some oil in my hair, and then were a little bit disturbed to discover that it didn't braid quite the way they were expecting because it was too slippery. So they said, well, how do you do your hair at home? And I said, well, I straighten it a little bit. And they were like, you have the straightest hair we've ever tried to work with. You're totally wasting your time trying to straighten your hair. So, you know, having a bunch of girls laugh at me, telling me that I'm wasting my time straightening my hair, you know, might seem kind of laughable. It's a little bit uncomfortable, you know, a way to image Christ to people by just entering in to their life. But sometimes things can get really uncomfortable on a deeper level when we start bumping into those belief system kind of things. A number of years ago when I was living in Harrisburg, I was talking with a friend of mine who was a new believer, and he was sharing what God was teaching him in confronting his old way of life, because he had been living with a woman that he was not married to. And when he became a believer and discovered that that was wrong, he cut ties and he moved out. But then a little while later, she reached out to him and said that she had cancer and asked him to move back in and take care of her again. And I was kind of flippant in my reply, and I was like, well, she is an independent adult. Someone else can take care of her. She's not your responsibility. God will take care of this situation. Obviously, you know this is wrong. And my friend was a little bit frustrated with me, but he was very patient. And he pointed out that what I could so easily believe, being and growing up in this kind of independent white woman class of life, that was something really easy for me to believe. But for him, he grew up in a culture where the men take care of the women. And he was really confronting that because he felt like he was abandoning her in her time of need. He really taught me a great lesson that day when he urged me to be patient with someone, because what I was doing was actually really heaping guilt on him when he was trying to work through something with the Lord, and I gave him a really simplified reply and tried to make it sound like it was such a simple thing to understand. He had to put me in my place and encourage me to listen more before quickly giving advice that didn't take his genuine struggle into account. Now, Sarah also addressed fear as one of the major ways our identity has fallen in the area of security. And because of fear, we can be tempted to hide behind our culture or our beliefs or our way of doing things. Or sometimes we can tell ourselves that curiosity, just genuine curiosity, is wrong. And that if we drop our guard and ask people about their beliefs and their customs and the way that they do things and the way that they were raised, that somehow we're going to lose our own or somehow we're going to invite in some trouble. But if our security and our identity is rooted in Christ, we have the freedom to listen and to be genuinely curious. In fact, we should ask questions and listen to stories so that we can know others. If we were to stay in 1 Corinthians and just flip forward two more chapters, Paul would go on to explain that Christ has died for all of our sins and he is victorious. This means that we don't have to fear making mistakes because there's grace, meaning that Christ covers us. 1 Corinthians 15:58 says to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. And that's one of my favorite verses because I know that my efforts are short-sighted and downright clumsy. In many ways, it's humbling just to be up here in front of you right now knowing that I fail all the time at this. But my efforts not in vain due to the grace of the Lord, and he will use me even when I'm fearful. There is something else that we can hold as true as we look forward to the future. And Jen read this passage this morning, and I'm going to read it again because it really gives me a lot of hope. Revelation 7:9-10 says, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages standing before the throne and before the Lamb of God, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" This passage says that heaven is going to be filled with people from every tribe and tongue and nation. And let me paint this picture for you. Just imagine a throne room where God's sitting and his garments are so big they're filling the room. And all around are figures dressed in white robes, waving palm branches, worshiping the Lord in their own way. The hall is filled with many different languages, singing and chanting to the Lord. Some people are dancing and some people are kneeling. And looking around the room, it's easy to see that the sea of faces is not uniform. Some have freckles. Some have tattoos. Some have skin that's so dark that their white robes make a bright contrast. Some may have red hair. Or some, maybe we can't even see their hair because they're wearing a headscarf. Some of the hands holding those branches are smooth and soft, and others are rough and calloused from difficult physical labor. And these are just the things that we can see. We have no idea who's musical or who's technical or who is artistic or athletic or funny. Friends, we don't have to wait until the end of the world to see people created differently, serving and worshiping the Lord together. And now, granted, not every local church is going to be multi-ethnic, and that's not the goal. But we have this amazing unity and a sisterhood around the globe that we can recognize is growing right now. We need to take every chance we get to incarnate the gospel to one another and to the hope of the gospel, starting with the people in our own fellowships. Because just to reverse what Sarah was saying earlier, knowing and understanding builds love. And ultimately will bring more unity. And Sarah and I recognize that we're not as prone to getting off track in arguments or getting ensnared in the trap of fear and apathy when someone that we know is involved in something. Like, for instance, we care a lot about immigration policies because we don't like seeing our hardworking, honest neighbors get jerked around by systems, or we want to listen when our friends talk with us about the protests that they're involved in or how the news is affecting them. We care about issues like Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement because our friends are involved and we want to understand more. Love drives away fear. We don't have to push others away trying to protect ourselves because Jesus was certainly not trying to protect himself when he died on the cross for us. Because of the gospel and how our labor is not in vain, you can reach out and appreciate the differences of someone who seems to be radically different than you, especially if they call themselves a Christian. So you can just take the time, invite a friend out who seems radically different than you, and ask them how God is at work in their life and get to know more about their story. You're part of the same body. You may as well get to know them more because you're going to spend eternity with them. Now, I'm going to invite Sarah back up for some Q&A about how we as image bearers can work together to reflect him with our differences to a world that needs to know him.
Yeah, so we have some questions here that you guys turned in. If you want to write questions, you can kind of write it down, flag Jillian's attention. We'll try to get through as many as we can. So the first question, do you think conformity could ever be a way to love others, as in the idea of becoming all things to all men? So I think you're saying like entering in to the culture. Yeah. Huh. Do you want to go first? I have a thought, but if you want to.
Why don't you say your thought while I try to crystallize mine?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it conformity. I was a little confused when I first read it, but I think you're talking about entering into kind of a experience that's different than yours. And I think certainly the becoming all things to all men, that passage is super helpful and entering in. That doesn't mean I necessarily conform, you know, that I look just like them. You know, so you know, my best friend, for example, Black Panther comes out and she's screaming, Wakanda forever! Right? And I'm like, yay! Like, I get it to some degree. You know, she has a more deep understanding of what that means, but I can totally enter into that. I can ask her, like, I thought this was cool. What do you think about that? You know, I definitely can enter in and to just be okay with just kind of celebrating what she's celebrating, weeping with what she's weeping about. Yeah, so I don't know if I'd call that conformity, but I think it is very much being willing to just even enter into situations that you don't fully understand. You don't have to understand to show sympathy or solidarity. And you can ask to understand more.
Yeah, I agree, because I think I felt a little tripped up by the word conformity, too. But the concept of entering in, I would definitely say, there's just a lot of fun to be had by entering in with someone. Like, not trying to pretend that my life is their life, that's awkward. Yeah, I mean, if I've ever tried that, it's never gone well. No. But if I say something like, well, why don't you pick where we're going to go to dinner? Tell me about something, or can you cook food for me that you like? Can you tell me about stories that you like? What are the things that you grew up with? Take me to your church. Read a book or watch a movie with me that you enjoy and tell me about it. That's always been a lot of fun to just try to enter in. And granted, yeah, sometimes you don't always understand the same way. And I think it can be tempting to be like, oh, yeah, I do that too. I totally get it when you don't. But I think just appreciating, like, that's really cool. Thanks for telling me about it. Just really builds a lot of trust with people.
Yeah. Second one is, do you have examples of questions you've asked others who are different to understand their culture, experience, struggles, etc.? Examples of questions. I don't know if I have like specific examples. What I've found though is that love really does cover a multitude of sins. And I've found that if I enter in humbly and I really care, even if I don't ask the question well, for example, our neighbors, some of them wear headscarves and some of them don't. And I didn't really know why. And so I kind of said really, I was like, I was just curious. I was like, I'm just curious. And if you don't really want to answer this question, you don't have to, but is there a reason why, you know, your sister-in-law wears a headscarf and you don't? And she was totally chill. And actually, it was a really interesting conversation that led to all of these Egyptian cultural beliefs. And it was really, and it felt awkward because I was like, oh no, what if this is a terrible thing to ask? But, you know, I just kind of entered in with humbly and like, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I was just kind of curious and wanted to know. But we're also friends, so that makes a difference too.
Yeah. I think when there's a lot of trust or when people realize that you genuinely care about them, that can really break down a lot of walls. I find that sometimes just the questions that I would ask another person, whoever they are, even if it doesn't seem like we're starkly different, just asking them about what their family is like, what they like to do with their family. Sometimes those noticeable differences too, just asking them and saying, I'm just genuinely curious and I don't know. A lot of times people really like to answer that question. because people want to be known. They don't want to be such a mystery. They don't want to feel awkward. They want us to care about them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The last question we have, unless there are more that are being turned in, do you have any recommendations post-college for pursuing knowing others who are different from us? I guess post or now, but yeah.
Yeah, I actually find that reading a lot of books or blogs, biographies of people, that can just really help me to think about someone's life that's different than mine. Sometimes it's even helpful to read someone's story or to read someone's testimony. It's a great way to kind of interact with something different than me without the awkwardness of them sitting across from me. And I find that sometimes it even informs my questions then when I'm interacting with someone that might have some shared experience from a biography that I read, or sometimes if it's a historical figure that if they've recommended to me, I can ask, like, what do you like about their life and their story. Just genuinely, I think collecting stories really helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as my greatly wise mentor, Jen Martin, once told me, be a learner, kid. But seriously, you know, be a learner. Really, I think stories are great. I do a lot of just autobiographies while I'm driving in the car. I just listen, because I think as Americans, typically, I don't want to speak for all of you, but typically, we are very ignorant of the world around us, of even things in our country, of other people's experiences. Like, it's shockingly ignorant. If you talk even with other people from other countries, like, we were talking as a team, there was, I think she was a Christian woman from Tanzania, and she was saying that, like, we know what's going on in your country. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going on in ours. You don't even think to find out. That was just really powerful. So even to almost anticipate that you have a lot of blind spots that you might not even know you have, and to really just engage in that. So I feel like the past year for me has been a lot of books and podcasts, and that's really even prepared me for people as I've gotten to meet them. Like some of my neighbors, I knew some things about Egyptian culture, so it was actually really helpful, and I didn't look like a total idiot. But we love resources, so we have some of books. The resources. If you want to take a picture of any of these books, we have some podcasts. Yeah, really just be a learner and seek it actively. Because we live in an American isolation kind of ignorant bubble of world news, it won't happen. You won't just like fall into your lap and see it, so seek it out.
Yeah, sometimes you have to seek out like BBC News or something else, because we don't always get that here. And I've got a lot of Turkish friends who, when they start talking about politics in Turkey, if you've been following that in the last year or two, it's pretty interesting. When I've been hearing them talk about it, I was totally ignorant. I thought, what is happening in Turkey? I don't know. So I started reading it so that I could dialogue with them about it. And they were actually really impressed and encouraged that I would care enough about their family and their friends back home that I would try to understand the tumultuous political situations happening there.
I mean, even something else, a little bit different. Somebody on our team is pursuing a master's in social work. So as she's even talked about trauma and trauma-informed, it's been actually super helpful in discipleship to realize just really hard experiences in people's lives actually shift biologically and create these different ways of responding. And so even, thinking very broadly about differences, it's kind of, you know, we've been talking about a whole range of things, and it's probably going to look different for each of you, and you'll have to think about what that is. So it's differences is very broad. But to really think about very creatively, you know, like trauma even can be something that's really informative. I feel like I've been learning a lot.
I think the question, I see my life is full of uniformity. How do I begin to move towards people different from me? I was thinking, I almost added in a couple more comments at the last minute to my talk, and I was like, oh man, this could probably end up badly if I go off script. But I was actually thinking about how sometimes the people that I might assume are most like me are the people that are really frustrating and hard for me to get along with. Let me give you an example. Like, a little while ago, I was in a room full of women that generally looked a lot like me, and on the surface, we looked like we ought to be able to talk and have, you know, discussion. And I realized we were just coming at things from a really different perspective. You know, some of us were kind of the big picture people, and some of us were more the detail people, and trying to solve a problem together just seemed really convoluted. And I was frankly overwhelmed. And it helped at one point to start thinking, well, how are we similar and how are we different? I might have thought on the surface that we were pretty uniform, but when I start thinking about the little idiosyncrasies and the little differences that make us special and unique, I started really thinking about us more as a body, started thinking more about our strengths and our weaknesses. So I think just dialing it in to a really small level and just paying attention to where the differences are and loving and appreciating those, even when they're hard, was really helpful. So that was even just something on a small scale, but... I know. Sometimes it's just been really helpful to kind of get out of my bubble and just do something where I am obviously very different from everyone else. I had an assignment when I was in grad school that I was supposed to actually go and seek out a situation where I was very obviously physically different from everyone else, and I went to a Hindu temple. That feeling of fish out of the water just stuck with me, and I think it's made me very. Empathetic to someone else. Now, when I'm in a room, I'm often thinking, who's the fish out of water, and how can I bridge that gap for them? So even just getting yourself into a situation where you do feel awkward and just remembering what that feels like can really build a lot of empathy.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm not the most relational person, and I'm also not the most aware person. So for me, what it looked like was literally little, like, challenges for myself, like, to think about what is really different for me. Like, I'm gonna go do that. And sometimes it's like, this sounds like so weird. It's like a once a month goal that I have of like, just because I'm just not very, it's not, if I don't make a goal, I will not do it. So like, there was one that was like, what was it called? International Women's Day, like feminist politics in Lancaster. And I was like, I'm gonna go, let's just go. And it was really great. I like really learned a lot, and everybody knew each other there. I didn't know anybody. They all like worked together, and I didn't know that was going to be the case. Mm-hmm. But it was great. And so to see, and I feel like even coming out of that, now I can see things more. So specifically if you're a person who's not super relational, not super aware, not very good at like reading the room, the more diverse experiences I have, the more I actually notice stuff. Where usually I'm just kind of going through my little life in my Sarah bubble.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one, maybe two more, depending how quickly we answer. I think they're both good, though.
I know.
Let's go for both of them. Let's do it.
Okay, we can do it. Okay. Right. Do you want to say something about one of them first?
Okay. Here's one. What should you do when you feel like you are the one who is different? How can you help others love you? First of all, whoever you are, I love you.
Yeah.
Because that's really hard.
Oh, yeah.
It really is. I think what I have noticed, so I've listened to two autobiographies recently. One is Trevor Noah, the other is Lecrae. And they're very different people, but there are some ways that they have some similarities, and they both talk about not fitting in, and that some level, there seems to be something in humanity where it feels like we often don't fit in. Like at one point in your life, you will probably feel like you don't fit in. But the way that, I think it was Lecrae specifically, was talking about, you know, ultimately, that's a reminder that this is not our home, that this is not ultimately even where, you know, there will be a day when things fit. And so that's kind of the eternal hope, that good, that there's a part of a common experience of humanity is not really fitting in. And working through that and being honest with that, because as people start to share, you know, like High School Musical, suddenly vulnerability invites vulnerability, and people start sharing more. And the ways that you feel different might be different, but there's a unifying experience of that. I don't know, do you want to take the second part of that?
Yeah, especially the how do you help others love you, is whoever you are, I feel very encouraged to tell you, please don't give up. Please keep trying. Knowing that your labor is not in vain. You are doing a very good thing by trying to help other people understand you.
Yeah.
It was especially like my friend Henry that I mentioned in the story. He had to multiple times check me and say, Becky, you're a lot of things you don't understand. You need to listen more. and you need to stop talking. And when I, and as I learned, and as he learned to really check me a little bit, I think his patience with me and his love for me really helped me realize how much I need to listen more to people who are different than me. So please don't keep trying. And I would say maybe even pray for situations where you can find someone who feels like a bit of a bridge, or you can just share with them and ask them about themselves and then say, can I tell you about me? I think you'd find it interesting what God's doing in my life. Be bold. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need mm-hmm. someone in our face to say, I think you need to pay attention to what God's doing in my life. It's really great. It's going to get our attention. Please do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's a ministry in and of itself. Yeah. The last one is, how do non-believers fit into unity? How can we include these people in our unity effectively in order to bring them to Christ? Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked this question, because that was something that I kind of wanted to get into, and I felt like I didn't quite. I think true unity is evangelistic in and of itself, because we don't see it in our world often. Mm-hmm. You know, I do remember one of the things that actually drew me to the fellowship my first semester, because I was not particularly interested in Jesus at the time, but what drew me was the people, that they were so different, and that on the surface, they didn't seem to have anything in common other than Jesus for a lot of them. And I was just very intrigued by that and wanted to know.
Yeah, I think if we create a culture where we're genuinely curious about people and want to get to know them, I think that is going to be very welcoming. Jesus entered in with us that way by just mm-hmm. living life with us. He asked people some pretty interesting questions sometimes too. So I think by just living life with people who are different, and taking the time when you ask them to share a little bit about their story, to share some nuggets of the gospel and just really incarnate Jesus, act out Jesus to them, I think that really is very evangelistic. Yeah.
Well, that's all of our okay. questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you all for being here.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Teaching from Disciple Makers. To learn more about Disciple Makers, check out our website at www.dm.org or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/disciplemakers. Disciple Makers, reaching the campus, reaching the world.